This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from the City University of New York. Today, an interview with James R. Jones about black capital. Panelists for today are Aliza Luft from UCLA, Neda Magbule from the University of Toronto, and Clayton Childress from the University of Toronto. This discussion was recorded on April 11th, 2019.
We're having a Sociology Annex conversation with Dr. James R. Jones, Assistant Professor of African American Studies at Rutgers University, Newark. James is one of the discipline's most exciting early career researchers on race, politics, and culture, and in fall 2019, he's taking up a postdoctoral fellowship at Princeton's Department of African American Studies to work on his book manuscript about racial inequality in the congressional workplace, titled The Last Plantation. He has a new paper titled Theorizing a Racialized Congressional Workplace in an Edited Volume on Race and Organizations, which is an extremely fruitful and exciting field of study at the current moment. So, James, it's great to have you with us on the Annex.
Thank you guys for having me.
So those who follow you online might know you from your Twitter handle or your website, both of which are at Black Capital, and capital here is spelled with an O. What's the story behind that name?
Well, the short story is my name is James Jones, and I can never get an email or any type of account with my actual name. So I'm always forced to be a little bit creative. And so I remember when I guess, at my first messenger account on AOL, and I picked something stupid, like French Jones. It's like, ugh. I started taking French in the sixth grade. I was like, oh, this is something that'll stay with me for life. So I think I was a little bit more cautious when creating my Twitter, as you know, you're thinking about this as a brand, at least within academia. So it was for me, you know, my love of politics, particularly as it was happening in Congress. It's a way of paying, I guess, like an homage to that. But in many ways, what it is, it evolved to like my understanding of my research identity. And the central ways in which Congress plays into that, but also Washington, D.C. as a space. So I see Washington, D.C. and also like Congress as a sort of black capital, as a sort of locus of black politics. And that has been institutionalized, and I'm trying to understand how that sort of works, contemporarily.
That's awesome. So something I've noticed is that, you know, I think Black Capital is an awesome Twitter handle and website name. Also, I think your titles are so good. So I'm really curious to hear more about a couple titles. You know, I mentioned your book, and you have a 2017 piece in Du Bois Review that's really amazing. So maybe we'll just like have you go through some of your titles and tell us about these papers. So maybe we can start with the Black Nod. It's something you wrote about in that 2017 Du Bois Review article. The full title of your paper is Racing Through the Halls of Congress, The Black Nod as an Adaptive Strategy for Surviving in a Raced Institution. So tell us both about the Black Nod and also just the paper overall.
Yeah, so it starts with me interning in Congress. So I went to George Washington University in D.C. For undergrad, and I interned in Congress my first summer on the Hill. And then I worked in that same office for about a year and a half in college, and it was like the most amazing job. And it's just amazing working in Congress, feeling you're contributing to something bigger than yourself. And then it came to a point, I think it was in my junior year, I was like, well, I think I need to like branch out and do other internships in DC. And then I came back to work in Capitol Hill because I needed to like fill that urge one more time, but I decided to work in a different office. And this office was not headed by it was not diverse. There was only one person of color out of like this staff of 10. Whereas my last office was headed by a black member of Congress, and it was like the majority of people were of color, and it was just a really different atmosphere, one where I felt supportive, but in this new position, I didn't. And in short, like, I just had a horrible experience that year or that semester. So what happened was I would try and get out of the office as much as possible. and so I would go do deliveries. I would go to the Capitol, go pick up a flag or something. And, you know, I started nodding and also noticing people or Black staffers nod. But for me, it was this way of like surviving in Congress, made me feel connected to other Black staffers, and really gave me the motivation to like sort of survive in this white dominated space, which was unusual for me. And then the next semester or the next year, I went to Columbia to go to grad school, and had a class with Peter Behrman. And I told him my idea. I was like, yes, that's a great project that will get funded by NSF, which it did. And I went and I did this project where I, one, observed Black staffers nodding in the halls. And then I would talk to them about their experiences and what the nod meant. So I would sort of pretend to be someone who had no idea what this gesture was. It's like, oh, I've noticed you just did something in the hallway. You just nodded to that person. Did you know that person? And they was like, oh, well, no. It's like, well, do you do this with every Black person? They was like, yeah. I was like, you don't know about this? I was like, no. And so in many ways, they were like, sort of tell me about, I got them to tell me about this. And then one person famously said, you know, as a sociologist, you should know this. This should actually be your project. But it was a really way of understanding the contours of Congress as a racialized institution. So one, showing how it's a sort of white dominated space, but also in many ways how race is sort of reified and policed, right? So it was Black staffers who were doing this gesture. And this gesture is not necessarily unique to Congress, but it was interesting in how it was policed, right? This is something that you were expected to do. It was a part of their professional identity, something that helped to build social capital, and sort of reify racial boundaries and sort of end this way.
Can I just say, this is such an incredible example of taking a personal experience and thinking about it sociologically and using your sociological imagination. I mean, this is what we try and get our students to do all the time, using your sociological imagination to reflect on your own experiences and your day-to-day life and things that might be going on and think about larger meaning behind it and where those meanings come from. And I just love that. I love how you went from, okay, I had this experience when I was an intern doing blah, 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 and then I got an NSF and now I'm writing a book about it, you know, and thinking about racialized institutions. It's just such a fantastic example of using your sociological imagination to think about the world at large and beyond our own personal experiences.
Absolutely.
Sure. James, I have to ask. So in this like lingua franca of nods and gestures, mm-hmm. right? This kind of like shared repertoire. Tell me about what does a transgression look like within these scripts or within these repertoires?
So the biggest transgression is not to enter into the exchange or this interaction. So it's not to nod. It's to avoid eye contact, right? And so, you know, Goffman writes about how like establishing eye contact is pretty important, not only for sort of establishing an interaction, but by avoiding this, you're not allowing the person to be an equal. And so that was really interesting, the ways in which the staffers that I talked to, the Black staffers I talked to, talked about what it meant when people didn't enter into these equalizing exchanges with them. So if there were not Black, oftentimes it demonstrated to them how they were invisible within this workspace. But the other flip side to this is when other Black staffers would not nod or engage in eye contact, they use this as a way to sort of draw boundaries about who was in the community and was trying to advance the race and those who were not, right? And so it's like, oh, you must not be down. You're really not for racial justice. Right, and you're not someone I actually want to be friends with, because you did not do this as a person of our racial group. Mm-hmm.
And was that a combination of? I would assume it's a combination, partially of like people being new and not knowing, and sometimes maybe people deliberately not engaging in the ritual.
So I think it's both, right? So in one way, it's it could be deliberate, right? Like, I don't want to enter into this exchange. I don't want to acknowledge you.
Yeah.
But the other ways it was really interesting is that particularly there was a sort of generational divide, and that I sort of found the data in which older Black staffers, those who had worked in Congress longer, they were very adamant about nodding. And this is a practice that everyone should do, particularly to build social capital.
Yeah.
And they were really upset when a younger generation of Black staffers didn't do this. And so part of it was like them lamenting about how this younger generation didn't understand the problems, the persistent problems that the group was facing.
Yeah.
But it was also those moments where you were sort of like chastised, like, oh, you, how come you're not nodding to me? You should be doing this. This is what you do. Mm-hmm. And they're sort of used as an education. It's like, all right, you must be new to the Hill. We nod to other Black staffers here. This is how you're going to survive and like thrive in this space.
So that's an article that's available. Folks can get it through their favorite library. They could probably also hit you up for it if they're not able to access it. But for us, one of the perks of being able to host Soch Annex this week is that we got to look at a preprint of a new paper by you. And so you circulated to us this new paper you have coming out. You're taking, you know, some of the things that you've elaborated so beautifully at the micro level, at the interactional level in your Du Bois Review article, and you're starting to scale it out. And so the title of this preprint that we got to read is called Theorizing a Racialized Congressional Workplace. And you set up this paper by saying that Congress has been narrowly conceptualized by academics as merely just a political institution. Mm-hmm. So tell us, whet the audience's appetite a little bit. Tell us how you're pushing back against this framing of Congress as just a political institution in your paper.
Yeah. So again, this comes out from my experience. One is as someone who has worked in Congress and who's done research there. And, you know, I see the multiple actors who are involved in policymaking. So it's just not congressmen, but it's their staff. And these staffs are sometimes not diverse, but what I witnessed firsthand was the important roles, you know, the Black political capital of these staffers in trying to influence policies. And so what I've noticed, particularly in the literature on congressional workplace and Congress as a whole, is that we tend to not acknowledge these actors. So it's doing two things. So one, it's kind of ignoring how Black professionals in particular shape the congressional workplace and congressional operations more broadly. But the other thing that it does is that it ignores how Congress and lawmakers have actually structured their workplace to make it for an unequal experience for these staffers. So these staffers help us to understand Congress in a new way, particularly in how it's racialized. And like, so they're both pushing up against the structure, and they are shaped and constrained by the structure as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the paper tries to do is call out these sort of race-neutral approaches to understanding Congress and the congressional workplace, and really tries to show the ways in which race is sort of constitutive and organizing force within the congressional workplace all the way into the beginning, right? And so part of it is looking at not only how race, but also social class shapes this workplace. So I start in four critical junctures. So I begin with like the slave era. And so we look at how both enslaved laborers, Black enslaved laborers contributed to the building of the Capitol, but also how they were free Blacks working and constructing this Capitol as well. And I use both class workers throughout the analysis to understand not only how Congress is a racialized institution, but how it transforms, right? So the big finding or the big idea in the race and racism literature is that racism, you know, it's ever changing, and it must change in order for it to have some type of permanence within our society, right? And so part of the ways in which, you know, Congress gets to change its image and appear more embracing or is by sort of absorbing this middle class of Black workers. And it says, hey, we're diverse. So we have more Black political staffers, right? This is actually a headline that came out in the New York Times a few weeks ago. And it's like, oh, this is great. Congress is more diverse, right? Even now we have headlines about this new Congress and it's the most diverse ever. But it's important to understand how the congressional workplace operates, how it's racialized. And so how you might have some diversity at the top, but it's also important to look at the people who are at the bottom. And so particularly this, the groups of service workers who are mostly of color and who are technically are not actually even congressional employees because they've been contracted out. Mm-hmm. And as indicating as how Congress and or how race shapes Congress and the operation of work with inside of its halls.
Yeah, your paper does an excellent job of sort of describing the way that labor is stratified within Congress, and you're doing this both across time, but you're also doing it across space. And I really appreciated your attention to physical space of Congress as racially segregated. Could you share a couple examples from your research or from the paper about that, the kind of physical segregation?
Yeah, I mean, so again, this is something that was born out of my internship experience, right? And so looking at physical space within Congress. And so one of the jobs that I had as an intern, and I believe they still do it a lot, is I go get letters signed. So, you know, lawmakers want to protest the president or like a secretary, and they'll get all these lawmakers to basically sign this letter and they'll send it off. So it's an intern who goes and gets these letters signed from members of Congress and their staff. And so I got to see how, you know, there was just different demographics in different spaces. And, you know, white offices led by white lawmakers would have predominantly white staff, and Black lawmakers would have Black staff. And the same thing would go for Latino lawmakers and Asian American lawmakers, right? And so it's very segregated space. One paper that I'm working on now is looking at physical space in the terms of the cafeteria and Congress. And so I'm looking at particularly one case in the 1930s in which Congress sort of ruled that it was allowable to segregate based upon race because Congress actually wasn't a public space, but it was a private space set up for the convenience of members of Congress. And so in this way, we actually have racism codified into legislative rules. But we typically don't understand this if we're not looking at a very narrow feature of what Congress does, which is as a governing institution. But we have to look at it how as a social space, right, as a workplace, and the rules in which maintain this sort of social space as well. Mm-hmm.
And has that kind of structural relationship, even in the cafeteria, I mean, has that ossified and you can still see that today?
Yes and no, right? So in many ways, I would sort of call it like a cosmopolitan canopy and like thinking okay. Like Elijah Anderson's way.
Sure.
But so it's not that, you know, that this space is segregated anymore, but it's still stratified. And so these workers are all of color. And they all started to have a much more precarious position within the congressional workplace. So they are not technically federal employees. They are contracted out by a third party. And so they just have a different arrangement. They make less money than they would as government employees. And so what's been interesting is that in the point that I drive on this paper is that the cafeteria is this really interesting site of protest. And so I believe it was in the 2016 Democratic primary or presidential primary overall, where you had a number of cafeterias workers striking because they wanted a living wage. Some of them were homeless. And they basically sort of argue, it's like you have all these people who are running for president and who work in this body and who we serve. And they're talking about promoting a living wage, but they don't do that for the people who they basically employ and oversee. Mm-hmm. So it's this interesting site to sort of see how inequality works in Congress.
Mm-hmm. And James, if I can follow up on something you said, in some ways, like this paper and the paper that you're working on, they are helping us as maybe people who have not worked on the Hill or who are not as familiar with the inner workings of DC, it makes us reevaluate spaces like Congress or Capitol Hill and to think, right, how do they resemble other workplaces? Yeah. It's kind of stripping them, right, of some of their specificity or their allure, the kind of like West Wing or Veep notions we might have of it as like a special place. But then also your overall book manuscript, it shows the nuance that in fact, like, you know, the title is The Last Plantation. And in many ways, Congress has shaped itself as a place that is above or somehow exempt from some of these sort of basic protections that we would find in other workplaces. So I wonder if you could sort of introduce us to your book and talk a little bit about this tension of Congress as at once a not special place to work that resembles many other workplaces, but also historically how it has been exempted from other things.
Yeah. So I got this question a lot when I was doing talks on the Black Nod. And it was like, well, there will be people saying, oh, yeah, I've seen this there in these other organizations, institutions, universities. And so it doesn't make Congress special. And so there are many parallels between Congress as racialized institution and other organizations worldwide, right? So there are these similarities and like the things that I'm witnessing in many ways are not that different than other white dominated institutions. But I think the thing that really makes Congress exceptional is its ability to exempt itself from the rules and to impose itself and sort of impose a racial order on society, but again, exempt itself from it. So like my book project really takes, it starts from that exemption, right? And this is the idea behind The Last Plantation. So in the 1970s, Congress, or actually lawmakers and staffers, started calling Congress the last plantation because it exempted itself from the 1964 Civil Rights Act, right, which had ruled status-based discrimination as unlawful. So basically, you were not allowed to discriminate based upon race or gender in any part of American society. Like, this is ruled unconstitutional, I mean, or like unlawful, and, you know, we're going to have a new racial epic. But in that new racial epic, the only place where you were allowed to act with impunity was Congress itself, right? So they sort of reasoned that Congress was the last plantation, right? It was the last place where this could occur in this new period. And so this idea of the last plantation circulates from the mid-1970s until 1995, when Congress finally closed this sort of loophole. But the ways in which this idea of the last plantation was talked about, at least from lawmakers, was all about this loophole. Whereas Black workers use this plantation to talk about a broader or much more broader system of racialized work. And so when I use The Last Plantation in the book, I sort of discuss how it originated, but talk about how this was a much bigger phenomenon that both predated this designation of The Last Plantation in the 1970s and both outlasted it, right? And so the idea is that Congress is constantly transforming itself as a racial institution. And so we need to actually understand, one, that it is a racialized institution, and then two, how does it operate across time and space in different ways?
So I have a question, because I was thinking about Congress and the ways in which it is representative of other racialized institutions and the ways in which it isn't. Mm-hmm. And one thing that came to mind was thinking about the military as actually one of the very first institutions in American history that was formally integrated. Mm-hmm. You know, way before Brown versus Board of Education in 54, the military is legally integrated in 1948. And that's another branch of government, you know, the military, and thinking about, so it made me think about different extremes and in how organizations and institutions aren't racialized. And I would love to hear you speak about institutions that you think are similar to Congress and those that are different, perhaps on a spectrum of practices of racialization that you identify in your work.
Yeah, so I actually did a talk at New Brunswick not too long ago. And what was interesting being in a room with political scientists, like, oh, well, Congress in many ways resembles all of these different, you know, legislatures across the world, right? So this is not necessarily a U.S. phenomenon, but something that's worldwide in the ways in which legislatures exempt themselves from the rules. But in many ways, I think a strong parallel to Congress as a racialized institution is, and thinking about their racial history, is with universities. And so I think it really begs the question about what these institutions do. And so on the surface, you know, universities are all about teaching and, you know, Congress is all about governing. But another way to look at them is how universities and how Congress both create and structure our racial order. Mm-hmm. So Craig Wilder's book is like, you know, I love it, Ebony and Ivory. And so part of the argument is that, you know, all of these elite universities that we have a racist history. The other part that tends to get ignored from his book is how not only were these universities have a racist history, but they were actually influential and essential to creating our racial order, right? Through the production of racist knowledge, through supporting the institution of slavery. In the same way, I think about Congress in this way, right? So Congress not only has a stratified workforce, but it's, you know, it's producing racialized laws, which could either, you know, create racial categories or reward whiteness or, you know, punish those who are in non-white categories. It's also producing knowledge. And the other thing that I'm starting to develop in this book project is how it's really about cultivating a group of political professionals who run our political system and who turn out to be majority white, right? And so in this sense, it's not necessarily about like what they do on the surface, but it's how they structure the racial order. And, you know, Congress has a similarity in many ways to universities in that they're playing a powerful role in shaping our racial order that it's not typically noticed or acknowledged.
It's really great. I'm really looking forward to your book.
Yeah, and one of the really exciting things about it too is we get both sides of that, of like, you know, Congress and the power of Congress, but also just is a fairly mundane everyday space. And within that, you know, one of the arguments I really loved about the new article is that just at the level at which, you know, supposedly mundane organizational decisions within a racialized organization have real consequences. One of the ones that really stood out to me that I wanted to hear more about was legislative staff organizations and decisions around those and just kind of what those are. Is that something you could talk about?
Yeah. So this comes out of the sort of 1995 Congressional Accountability Act. So this is actually pretty interesting. So at the same time that Congress has ended, you know, this exemption from, you know, federal workplace law, so it applies it in 1995. And so in many ways, what happens is that the designation of Congress as the last plantation is like formally ended, right? And there are a whole bunch of quotes in the book about how there's this sort of celebratory moment in Congress where it's like, oh, we've done it. We've stopped becoming a racist institution. We're just like everyone else. But also in that year, what Congress does under the leadership of Newt Gingrich is that it rules that legislative staff organizations can no longer use space within Congress, and that members of Congress can no longer fund these out of their accounts. So basically, what these legislative staff organizations are these sort of mini organizations or collaborations between different caucuses. And they sort of produce, you know, laws and bills. So legislative staff organizations serve an important function in Congress, particularly for those who have or occupy a more subordinate role within Congress. So if you are a powerful member of Congress, you will have a bigger staff, you will have a position on a committee, and you will have more staff people to sort of develop your political agendas. However, if you are on the margins in Congress, you have less resources to influence the formal political agenda. And so what legislative staff organizations do is allow different members of Congress to sort of pull the resources together to influence the formal policymaking agenda, right? So particularly the most famous one of these organizations is the Congressional Black Caucus, right? So Black members of Congress would collectively donate out of their resource accounts money to hire staffers who could coordinate different political agendas and then have that to use to sort of influence the formal political agenda. So, you know, every year the Black Caucus has its own budget, right? And so that they sort of mount against whatever the dominant budget is offered by, let's say, a Democrat or a Republican committee. But you have this other budget that's mounted by, let's say, the Black Caucus or even the Progressive Caucus has started doing this. But basically what Gingrich did was outlaw the use of this, right? So they couldn't have space in Congress, and you couldn't use your funds to do this, right? He sort of said that this was sort of wasteful. But in many ways, what this was an attack on the work of women and people of color inside Congress to actually challenge the organization of work as a sort of racialized institution in Congress. But I think the point that Clinton sort of brought up is that, you know, often, particularly within, I would say, American political development, there is this attention to critical junctures. And so we need to look at those big moments where things transform, right? And this is also in the institutions literature, right? These are the things that like really turn the organization to move in this sort of critical direction. And we need to understand that. My position as like a qualitative researcher is that we also need to look at the moments in between those critical junctures, right? So they're often mundane, but they help us understand how we get to those critical junctures, right? But it's in those daily interactions and daily experiences, right? This is like, you know, a part of like the Black nod.
Yeah.
But this is also something that is evident in other sociological research. So one paper I would highlight is from Paolo Parigi in, I believe it's AGS in 2016. So he's one of the other few sociologists who are studying Congress. And so he has this great paper in which he's looking at where members of Congress live and how that affects policymaking. So in short, in the 1840s, you know, members of Congress lived in boarding houses. And basically what he showed is that where you lived and who you lived with mattered more than your political party on how you would vote on particularly partisan issues. So again, it was like, you know, this idea about who you know and social capital that's actually driving these sort of electoral outcomes and not these other markers that we would typically associate with voting.
Wow. James, I think that's actually like a perfect way to go to our last question, which is something that I think must be on the minds of the listeners, given that they've heard your background is that you worked on the Hill before coming back to academia. Before that, you were a political science major as an undergrad. And so how did you end up getting your PhD in sociology? And I feel like in some ways, the richness of that answer you just gave us maybe is a clue into what drew you to Soch, but I'd love to hear more.
Well, in short, you know, I love politics. And so I had just gone through all the classes in the political science department that focused on inequality, that focused on, you know, Black politics, minority politics more broadly. And there was just, it was just uninteresting, to be honest. And so at that same time, I had taken my first sociology course in my freshman year, the sociology of AIDS. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. And like, I went to college not knowing what sociology was. I did not know this existed. But this class sounded cool. I started liking the professor. I took other classes with her. And, you know, every semester I would take a course in sociology. And it was like the best class. It gave me, it just was relevant for my world, understanding my world. And so, you know, I was working on Capitol Hill and, you know, we staffers actually, you know, do realize or utilize sociological research. And so I was like, you know, this is helpful. And so I want to be a part of the research that you're using to change policy. And so I went to sociology for grad school.
And have you seen some impact from your work since you've come back to sociology?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting thinking about, you know, our earlier conversation with doing more public work. And like, I have seen evidence of this, right? So it has implications about how I do research and how I'm seen in the field now. Mm-hmm. But in 2015, I wrote a policy paper on the top staffers in the Senate. And basically what I found, surprise, surprise, is that it's majority white workforce. And staffers of color only make up about 7% of the top staff positions in the Senate. So these are the chiefs of staff. These are communications directors, legislative directors, and committee staff directors. The way that my respondents describe these positions is as this is rarefied air. You are setting the agenda when you're in these positions. However, people of color are locked out of this. And so there isn't any data on the racial demographics of the congressional workforce at all. Mm-hmm. So even though it applied some of the civil rights legislation, like the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission doesn't collect data on the congressional workplace. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I did a census on this and produced this data, and it really changed the conversation on Capitol Hill about representation, in part because I was applying data in which there wasn't any data before this. But, you know, part of the impact was that Senator Chuck Schumer actually adopted my policy recommendations. Mm-hmm. And so one of the most influential ones, I think, was that he is in the Democratic caucus in the Senate, and to a certain extent in the House, are now releasing data on the demographics of, you know, who they employ, mm-hmm. which has been unheard of and has never actually happened.
That is so exciting. That's really amazing. And so I think you're going to be top of mind for when we're thinking about, right, our rejoinders and our replies when people say, right, there hasn't been evidence of sociology making that public impact because your research has penetrated that rarefied air.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, what a great way to come full circle. I wish we could high-five each other right now. And this is such fascinating work, and it's so, so important. So I'm really excited about it, and I'm excited that via the podcast, hopefully more people are going to learn about it. It's great.
And when does the book come out?
Well, I'm going to Princeton next year to hopefully finish it.
Yay. Wonderful.
So shortly after that, hopefully.
You've been listening to The Annex, an academic sociology podcast. You can visit our show site at sociocast.org/annex. We are on Twitter at SociAnnex and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. Music by Lena Orsa. I'm Joseph Cohen. Thank you for listening.